Rabbi Avi Killeth, and I am here this time with Rosh Yeshiva of Hadar, Rabbi Ethan Tucker, and our special guest, Rosh Yeshiva Rabbi Aviva Richman. Welcome, Rabbi Ethan and Rabbi Aviva.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
How are you doing, Avi?
You know, I'm hanging in there. It's hard to believe that we were last gathered pre-Pesach, and we are now gathered thinking about the high holidays, and yet still I'm still in my apartment speaking to you in your apartment.
I know it's been a crazy ride. Everything changes, and yet seems like the more things change, the more they stay the same these days.
And Rav Aviva, we want to welcome you to Responsa Radio. This is your first time on an episode. I think desperate times call for desperate measures, and we need even more wisdom than we're used to. So thank you for joining us.
I'll do my best. Really great to be here with all of you.
All right. I have two questions that I've picked out for us. And I'll say we call this Hilchot High Holidays, that we were going to do an episode of this podcast related to questions about what the High Holidays will look like this year. And I want to sort of start by prefacing that most of the questions that I pulled, maybe all the questions, seem to be questions about tefillah. They seem to be questions about prayer. But that I think within these questions are so many questions and so many layers of the big issues of what we're struggling with right now. What do we believe? How do we react to this moment? What does tshuva look like right now? So I would say that the questions are deceptively simple, and they may even be deceptively about tefillot. But that's sort of the introduction for the questions I chose. And the first question I want to ask is really deceptively simple. So the question, and we got many forms of this question in our call for questions in advance, is what tefillot should I say this year? Right? Such a simple question. What tefillot should I say this year? And there are so many versions of this question, right? One version is, do I have to try to get a minyan? One is, how much of the davening, how many of the prayers can I do if I'm praying alone? Another version is, how little of the davening, how few prayers can I say if I am praying together in a minyan, but we're limited by time or by singing? And I want to start by saying that this is an unusual question. We don't usually ask this question of which tefillot should I say. We turn to the Machzor for that, right? We have a book that can tell us the answer. Or for many of us, we don't even turn to the Machzor, right? We listen to somebody tell us which page of the Machzor to turn to. We leave this up to our leadership to tell us, you know, to make those decisions, which tefillot should I be saying this year? And this question has become suddenly a very personal question, which tefillot should I say this year? So I want to start by asking you, as our Rebbeim, to weigh in on this question. I want to start by asking you to leave for a minute the which tefillot part, and actually maybe start by giving us a little sense of the this year part. Why would this question be different this year? So either of you could jump in.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about this as I'm getting a lot of these questions. And, you know, in some ways, this is a question that different communities ask. Different times when designing their siddur or compendium that you're going to use in shul each year. So in some ways, it's not a new question, but it has a really different valence this year as people are trying to figure out, well, what do I have to say and what can I say? And I think some of the concern around how to answer this question is, well, you know, if I'm open to cutting certain parts of tefillah this year because we're just trying to do this as quickly and safely as possible, then does that suddenly open up some kind of Pandora's box? And maybe next year I won't get those PU team that I know and love. There'll be sections of liturgy that suddenly everyone wants to skip because, well, last year we did it in just an hour, so why can't we do the same thing this year? So I just want to name that sensitivity and concern and say that despite that, I think the concept of shad hadachak, right, a sort of pressing and urgent circumstance that people have been talking about for quite a while now and thinking about approaching coronavirus, that is a real category and it's a real experience, right? Knowing that people might be making choices this year about what to say or not to say that are really hard choices. And I would say, even if there is a little bit of like, yeah, I kind of wish tefillah were always shorter and we could get out of shul earlier, I think that there's also a really strong sense that people really wish we could be back in the regular, and we all kind of know that the choices that we are making are responding to reality this year that's just quite different.
Yeah. So let me make sure I understand that we understand what you're saying. Is it sounds like that the answers for this year, of which tefillot should we say, are not, in your understanding, they're not the answers going forward of whatever choices we're making this year. That's the new Shacharit Rosh Hashanah, and we're not going back to the old, that really these are for this year.
Yeah, though I do think it can be very illuminating at the same time, right? When you actually look at the bare bones of what can seem like endless pages of your Machzor, and you look at, well, what's actually the bare bones of this, you can have a greater appreciation for the structure and the arc, and hopefully that will stay with us for years to come, even if we go back to our usual.
Mm-hmm. That's nice. I can imagine like going through the Machzor with a highlighter this year to make sure I know what I'm going to include. And then in future years, maybe I'll say everything, but I'll still go over those highlighted pieces with like a knowing that they're, you know, they're emphasized, they're a little special. Rabbi-san, what do you have to?
Yeah. So I'll just jump in with sort of, I guess, kind of an overall comment and maybe a framing that might be helpful on this. You know, the obvious thing, I think it's sort of right, the elephant in the room. What's different about this year? Well, what's different about this year in one way or another is safety. Sometimes that's actually decisions made by protocols of doctors and governments and committees in shuls. Sometimes it's decisions being made by individuals in a lev yodea marat nafsho mode, that each person knows their own limits in terms of what feels safe for them. And the notion that sort of where we're coming to this from is from a kind of contingent place this year, I think we have to remember is coming from a contingent place of concern about health. That's going to look different for different people, different communities, different contexts. But there, I want to sort of, I think, drill down on two things. One is to sort of just emphasize, I think, what ought to be basic, but I think we can forget, which is that in moments of danger or, you know, concern about safety, it's very good and healthy to be reminded of the fact that tefillah b'tzibur, public communal prayer, while something of immense metaphysical importance and an incredible engine of connection and meaning, is not the kind of individual obligation that the fulfillment of other mitzvot is. That is to say, there's an obligation to hear the shofar. There's an obligation to pray. There's an obligation to hear the Megillah on Purim. The obligation, such as it is to be present in a minyan, is not like that. It's about fulfilling some kind of communal responsibility, some sort of corporate responsibility to praise and to pray to God in public. And in cases like that, I mean, I feel very comfortable saying this year, there simply is no obligation that people should feel to show up in public spaces when what is potentially on the line is the concern for their own or other people's safety. That's obviously true if there's been a directive that people shouldn't gather. But even if someone's in a space of the community has determined that it's safe to gather, I am not sure that I feel good about going into a space like that. You really shouldn't be clouded in that judgment by some concern of, oh my God, but I, as an individual, am supposed to be there. And in that sense, right, the notion that we're balancing some communal obligation against what individuals, what it's appropriate for them to do, I think has to be front and center, right? Sort of put in bold terms, don't be sitting with a guilty conscience of I'm defaulting on my Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur obligations if the right thing for me to do is to stay at home.
I appreciate you saying that. I think it's especially important for the High Holidays, which is this holiday that, you know, or these holidays, this moment in the year when so many Jews, even Jews who don't feel that obligation to show up in community, you know, suddenly the shuls are bursting at the seams. Suddenly everybody is there. That it really feels like there is some sort of, you know, different obligation to show up at this time. And so it's maybe even counterintuitive to be told, no, actually, this is not any more important necessarily that you show up in person than any given Shabbat.
Yeah, I think it's really hard. And you know, the emotional piece of these days, this is a statement particularly about shofar, but I think it's very powerful. The Talmud sort of understood this in a deep way, that people have this drive, almost uncontrollable drive, to participate in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And there are some times that we actually have to tell them, no, this is not the thing to do right now. It comes up in the explanation, seems to be a retrojection of a later theory, but that's neither here nor there. The explanation of why we don't blow shofar on Shabbat as it falls out this year, right? Why don't we blow shofar on the first day of Rosh Hashanah when it falls on Shabbat? And the sage Rabbah in the Talmud says, well, the scenario we're worried about is everyone's obligated in shofar, but not everyone knows how to blow the shofar. And so what's someone going to do? They're going to find any way they can to grab a shofar, carry it from one domain to another in a forbidden way on Shabbat to get it to some expert to blow it for them. And as a result, they're going to violate something about Shabbat in order to hear the shofar. And this gets applied even when there's sort of a concern, right, just sort of rabbinically, that you might do this, even if you're not actually going to. And I think encoded in there is sort of a sensitivity. Yeah, on the one hand, people are deeply connected to hearing the shofar. People are deeply connected to connecting on the days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And yet, at least Rabbah's understanding was, the response to that was not to find a way to lift the laws of Shabbat. The response to that was to cancel the obligation in shofar that would otherwise be there. And again, I don't want to overstep here. All of us want to see strong, robust communities this year and beyond. But it's something that's just sort of important to keep in mind. On some level, having a way to ground this in an individual experience, as opposed to thinking the only way to connect in is by doing something that feels unsafe or dangerous in public, is actually, I think, in certain ways, very much in keeping with how Chazal thought about some of the priority, balancing here.
Great. So then let's take it from the other side. You've convinced me that I can stay home, maybe even that I should stay home. Why should I consider going to a minyan? I would say I'm in New York City, which, you know, conversely, the last time we all spoke before Pesach was worst and scariest place to be in, now seems to be on the other side of that. So I would say in my neighborhood, there are many shuls, you know, bending over backwards to find ways to meet in backyards, outside, in tents. Why should we even be bothering if really we could all just be at home?
Yeah, so I'll just add that. And I think Rav Aviva will help take us through sort of how we make that manageable. I mean, the obvious reason, I'll put it maybe in the most melodramatic terms. The God of Israel wants and needs to be worshiped by his people in public. Right? That is to say, there is actually something about, this is an avodah, this is a service, this is something we're called to do. We're not called to do it when it puts us in danger, but when we're able to do it in keeping with guidelines, I think on the most basic level, this is a communal obligation we are called to carry forth. You know, it was a controversial decision this year, but the decision that New York City made to have a fireworks display on July 4th, at least in some form in the midst of the pandemic, was some notion of, well, we still got to mark that we're a city and we're patriotic and this is an important day. As they say, kal v'chomer ben benoshel kal v'chomer, like, you know, the highest level of, you know, of extrapolation by logic from that statement. We have to find ways within the limit of what we can do to do that. And I would say, to turn it from the other angle, the emotional piece here, I don't think we need to actually make that case, right, to so many people on these screens. We're dying to do that. And going back to how the Rambam talks about tefillah b'tzibur, public prayer in the first place, he nishma'at tamid, right? It is automatically and immediately listened to. That sense we have when we pray in public, that it's just going to work in a certain way. We're in greater doubt about its efficacy in private. So that's why I think we all want to be there, and we should be there if we can. We just shouldn't be there under duress or in the sense of an unwise decision because we think it's the only channel.
Yeah.
I think that idea of tefillah b'tzibur, or communal prayer, being avodah, right, just like the Beit HaMikdash, there was a service. People know that that's happening. And that's not quite the same as you individually needing to do all that you can. to show up. So this is really a choice about, you know, communities based on what is safe in those communities, making sure to have that in place, right? That can actually uplift the tefillot of people who can't make it to Minyan as well.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I think it's helpful to think about, actually, you know, I started by saying, look, we're exactly where we were in March. We're all in our same living rooms. And actually, we're not exactly where we were in March, because in March on this show, we talked about how sad and hard it is to know that maybe this Shabbos, there are no Torahs being read anywhere in the world. You know, that's what it felt like in March. And to know now that even if you choose to stay home, wherever you are in the country, there are minyanim that are fulfilling these mitzvot and gathering, and that makes us feel like as a people, we are fulfilling this obligation, even if we as individuals are staying home, it feels like a totally different thing. Okay, so back to our very complicated and simple question. I'm gonna restate our question. What prayers should I say this year? Maybe you can give us a little bit more. I'm seeing pop up in the chat, I have 45 minutes to lead Musaf. What am I supposed to do? So what do you have to say to us?
Yeah, I wanted to share a few thoughts about this question, which is obviously on so many people's minds in so many ways. And just to reiterate the fact that people need different answers to this question. You have the person who's maybe at home with multiple children, wondering if they're barely going to get a half hour to daven by themselves. And it's sort of like, what's the minimum I can do when it's just me and my machzor at home and I've grasped a few minutes of time? You have the different minions that are trying to figure out, well, if we stagger davening times and have just a small number of people, how can we fit the most smallest minyanim into the time span for tefillah to occur, and try and figure out as a community, what do I need to say? And then you have the people who are like, well, I'm going to be in my pod with five people in my home, and we want to have some sense of communal tefillah together, but we know we're not a minyan. What's the most that we can say, even if it's not a minyan? So I think it's important to really know where you are specifically and what you need on this question. I will say that we are going to have extremely detailed information on this on our website, including a sort of model abbreviated machzor for people to access. In general, the idea is that parts of tefillah that have really been entrenched since the times of the Talmud are core, and then the accretion, the beautiful accretion of various poetry and piyutim over the generations are actually not as necessary halachically, but that can be kind of ironic because often those beautiful poetic prayers are the ones that people feel more strongly connected to. And I would say, you know, as different communities and ad hoc minions are making these choices, it's good to weigh both of those features. So knowing what's like really the core skeletal bare bones, like for example, if we're thinking about Musaf Rosh Hashanah, that can feel endless. It can feel endless. In fact, the Rambam, Maimonides, this is one place where Maimonides says, even though generally we do the private Amida and the public Amida, what we think of as the repetition, there is a position going all the way back to the earliest of sages, Rabban Gamliel, who thinks that actually there only has to be a public Amida. When you have a collection of people, like, why do we say it twice? You might be wondering that. Why do we say this twice? It seems sort of redundant. And then actually there is a position that it only needs to be said once communally. Generally, that hasn't been relied upon, although there is some split on this in Ashkenaz and Sephardic communities. But this is one place where the Rambam says, for the Musaf Amida of Rosh Hashanah, that's a good time to just do the public Amida, even if people are kind of able to slog through the words. If it's going to be really tedious and difficult for people, then just have the public Amida, not the private Amida. It's sort of good to, there's definitely the exercise of this year of being grateful for the dynamic nature of our halachic canon, so we can draw on the voices that really feel like they're speaking most to our moment. And so within that, right, if it's sort of okay, as a minion, maybe we'd only do the public Amida. That's sort of one piece of thinking this through. Then there's, well, what is actually the core skeleton of that endless Musaf Rosh Hashanah, and to know that, you know, the different sections, there's sort of the three additional sections, Malchiyot, Zichronot, and Shofarot, about God's sovereignty and remembrances and Shofarot, those endless sections. We have 10 verses that we draw from across the Bible for each of those sections. There is a position from early on, from the times of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yochanan Ben Uri, who says that you only need one verse from each of the Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. And even later medieval sages, it looks like you could just mention that there are verses in each section of Tanakh. So, you know, it's sort of a moment to, I think, be grateful for seeing all these different positions that exist. What does that mean at the end of the day? Certainly a sort of fairly core position to rely on. And the Rambam, again, who says that one verse from the Torah, one verse from the prophets, one verse from Ketuvim, for each of those three sections, that can constitute those sections. And I would say, you know, so there might be people who are, when they're really trying to make this calculation, it actually ends up that 10 minutes will make a big difference. And I think it's worth thinking through whether that 10 minutes will actually make a big difference, or if we're just sort of like in some paranoid anxiety around wanting to trim down, but to the extent that it is actually necessary and helpful and sort of adds to the safety of people to rely on positions like that, I think that's helpful to see. And it is sort of a detailed discussion, and I'm looking forward to having widely accessible details on that. But the other thing I'll say is, I think, like you were saying, I loved your image of highlighting and having that highlight for years to come when we're feeling lost in the overwhelming, endless nature of the Matzah.
How special will that one pasuk that you say this year be in future years? You'll say, that's my pasuk.
Exactly. And it can sort of anchor and ground the sense of, oh, I know what this is about. It's actually manageable. I actually think there's a way in which it's going to be extremely empowering for people to get to know what's the core, so that it can kind of help anchor our orientation towards tefillah in a more ongoing way.
Thank you. I know it's really helpful. And it's helpful to me even just to hear the Rambam exploring that. I remember how meaningful it was to me to hear before Seder, the Rambam entertaining the question of, if you're doing Seder alone, I didn't even need to know what the end of the sentence was to know that Rambam entertained the possibility that the people doing Seder alone this year were not the only people doing Seder alone. I think even just hearing that Rambam, who of course would want the most possible verses as part of this Amidah, would be asking this question, it shows us that we're not outside of history, which I think it feels like we are right now, actually. Like we are, you know, we're not only in a bubble from each other, we're in a bubble from anything that anyone has ever experienced. And to know that actually, no, you're telling us, our sources tell us that there's wisdom, and there are Jews before us who asked this question, and they had to come up with answers. And then we can find in their answers both answers and also company, and maybe comfort in that sense that, like, yeah, we'll get back to our regularly scheduled tefillot. Rabbi Eitan, you want to add anything else on this?
No, I think that's good. I think we've covered it. And again, as Rabbi Aviva said, we are going to be sharing, you know, in an ongoing way, but also later this week in particular, some more concrete resources on this.
Yeah, I might just add one more, just because it's such a good story, and I think frames some of this question of how long do tefillot need to be. There's a story of Rabbi Akiva, when this is in Masechet Ta'anit, in the tractate that deals with what to do when there's not rain, there's drought, and you add to prayer, and you can add and add and add. And so the story of Rabbi Eliezer comes and adds all 24 extra blessings to the Amidah, and still no rainfalls. And then Rabbi Akiva says two short things, Avinu Malkeinu, Einanu Melech, Ela Atare. We recognize from our own recitation of Avinu Malkeinu, he says one more Avinu Malkeinu line, and then the rains fall. And that's it. It just took two lines. And the Talmud is sort of careful to say it's not because Rabbi Akiva was any better or any worse. It's because he was someone who was Ma'avir Midotav. He was a compassionate, forgiving person. And so when he got up there, that tefillah mattered. And I do think, in as much as we can get very anxious about what do we say, what don't we say, what mahzor is our shul using, do we have the right one? In some ways, it's a good moment to remember what really matters.
Yeah. Thank you. I love that. Because I thought this question had two parts, which is which tefillot and this year. And Rav Aviva, you're pointing out that there is an I actually in this question, which is which tefillot should I say this year? And actually maybe who I am coming to this question, which you're pointing out both in terms of, well, what's my situation? And also, you know, who am I and what kind of sincerity and meaning am I bringing to these words? Maybe the I matters as much as the which tefillot or the this year. So I think that's really, it's really useful. And since I am an I think that's actually probably a nice segue into our next question. I want to zoom in a little bit. We sort of said, oh, and we'll give you some details on the website to come. I want to zoom in a little bit on one particular issue of which tefillot should I say this year, which is this question that we received, which is, should I still say the vidui, which is the confession liturgy, in plural if I am alone? We're so accustomed to this language of why is the vidui in plural? It's because we're all praying together in community. And there's maybe something sort of stark and maybe even jarring about the idea of doing a plural confession when you are in a room by yourself and by yourself for the entirety of the chag. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on, you know, should we say vidui alone? What is the vidui? Why are we saying it in plural in the first place? And is the idea of not ever leaving our house this year, of not ever joining in community, does it change what this tefillah is and how we should use it?
Okay, so yeah, it's a great question. I think it actually has so many fascinating dimensions. I'll take just two pieces of it and then turn over back to the two of you. One is just sort of the general piece, which is sort of so familiar from the liturgy, which is kind of everything's in the plural all the time. You know, the place where I always find this to be so weird is when you say Tfilat HaDerech, right? The prayer for travel. And it's literally, I am going on a trip. I am nervous about this. No one else is going. You might be with your family in the car, but even if you go on your own, you say that in the plural. And there's this notion that everything that a Jew does in prayer is somehow with a communal mm-hmm. frame. So that's something that just transcends, you know, so many different prayers. There, of course, are prayers that are in the individual, but they get dwarfed overall by this communal frame. And, you know, perhaps the two of you will share a bit more about this. I think that's even more so when we're talking about confession, accepting responsibility, and we'll get more to what, you know, I think that's about here in the vidui, where there is a communal dimension to sin, to responsibility. You know, there are these statements that why should tzaddikim have to do vidui? Like, why should righteous people have to confess? What if you're someone, right, even if you wouldn't say this about yourself, there's other people you look at, you're like, they didn't do anything wrong this year. They're the most righteous people I know. And one of the standard responses is, yeah, but maybe there are people they could have objected to their behavior and they didn't, right? Maybe they had some leverage they didn't use. And there's just some notion that we're all implicated in everyone else's failures. That's part of arevut on some level, right? Ko Yisrael arevim ze bazeh is not just everyone sort of looking out for everyone else. Literally, it means everyone is on the hook for everyone else's failures. So the plural vidui, you know, gets at that on some level. The other piece I think is what is this about? And here maybe, you know, I'll jump a little bit to the aspect of your question of what's the minimum that we need to do here, or what, you know, what's sort of the core idea? And this is then bridges to our first piece of, you know, this has some practical ramifications for people trying to shorten the davening, but I'm more interested in it in terms of what it captures about this confession. So look, vidui is something, the notion that you confess, it appears in the Torah and a number of places surrounding sacrifices, and most centrally and dramatically in the Torah's telling in Vayikra chapter 16 of what happened on Yom Kippur in the temple. There's a confession by the Kohen Gadol, by the high priest, right? V'yitvada alav et kol avonot b'nei Yisrael. He confesses on the head of the goat all of the sins of the people. And that kind of establishes the notion that while a person should, in theory, always be confessing and owning up to things they did wrong, there's a sort of unique home for that on Yom Kippur. Right? Yom Kippur is uniquely receptive to that mode of confession. And that sets up clearly a paradigm for our sages where they deeply integrated confession into the liturgical rhythm of the day. So you find this, it starts in the Tosefta, it's brought in a parallel in Masechet Yoma, what we're familiar with, which is basically at every prayer service of Yom Kippur, you are confessing. And that takes up a lot of pages in the Machzor in the private Amida, takes up a lot of pages in the Machzor in the public recitation of the Amida. But all of that is in a sense a kind of fulfillment of this basic notion that you're supposed to confess your sins at each Amida. Now, where I think this gets fascinating is you then get a discussion in the Talmud in Yoma, what is the vidui, right? Like, it's sort of a quintessentially like Jewish rabbinic question, right? Like you can't leave
everybody
it.
Everybody knows
like,
you have to do it, but what is it?
Yeah. And like, you know, it's not enough to tell people like, feel bad and confess. It's like, yeah, but what am I supposed to say, right? What are the words I'm supposed to articulate? And it's this cornucopia of opinions there. You have Rav, Shmuel, Levi, Rabbi Yochanan. Everyone weighs in with different traditions, which if you look at the sugya there, it's amazing to see all kinds of things from the Machzor that you think of as like, oh, that's that next random paragraph, that next random paragraph, are actually the positions of all these different sages, that we sort of grabbed all the things they said and wove them into one elaborate confessional. And at the end of all of that, seemingly as exhausted as some of us can sometimes be at the end of some of it on Yom Kippur, Marzutra comes in and says, yeah, but that's only if you haven't said, aval anachnu chatanu. If you haven't said, but we sinned, then all these sages were like, you should say this, you should say that. But says Marzutra, if you said, aval anachnu chatanu, actually, you don't need to say anything else. Okay?
Less is more.
Yeah, less is more. There is, you know, there's biblical echoes to that, the notion that King David, sort of, how do you solve the conundrum that King David commits such horrendous sins and yet is so beloved by God? And I actually think the simplest answer to that is lying there right in the biblical text, which is when Natan HaNavi confronts him, he says, Chatati. Like without hesitating, he's like, you know what? You're right. I blew it. And it's almost like that's what we're looking for in a person. We're not looking for a perfect person. We are looking for someone who is able to admit error and to do so without hesitation. So Marzutra, I think, is inviting us in a very powerful way to say, you want to know what vidui is about? It's great. You can make up your acrostics, your long paragraphs, whip yourself up into a frenzy. But what I actually want to see, are you able just to sit in 10 seconds of silence and say, I messed up? And if you did that, you've done what you're supposed to do.
It makes me wonder, actually, if we were all given a choice, right, between all of this unending liturgy or actually confessing to something, that it actually can feel like, oh, thank God we have the liturgy. Because actually confessing is really asking a lot of us.
Yeah, there is a vulnerability to aval anachnu chatanu, if said and holding it, that you can easily evade by motoring through the double alphabetical acrostic of al chait and punctuating it rhythmically with hitting your chest.
10 times.
Yeah, and not letting it go in. So just to sort of close that piece, and this is where I think you get the power of the idea with some potential, you know, important flexibility, again, pending all the considerations that Rav Aviva alluded to before that different communities are grappling with. So, you know, the different poskim emphasize, like Rambam says, that's the essence of the vidui, aval anachnu chatanu. The tour comes along and says, anything beyond that, is common practice, but it's not of sort of the same normative force, right? Al-Khait, it's reported. Some communities said it, some communities didn't say it. It's unimaginable, right? To ask me to imagine a Yom Kippur without Al-Khait, right. It feels like another religion, right? But to confront, and this I think goes to what Rav Aviva was also saying is so powerful this year, these crazy situations maybe make you confront, what was I supposed to be doing all along? And there's this notion that that's it. some later authorities, the Prisha, the Shla, they claim, I think with some, you know, good basis, that Avala Nachnu Chatanu doesn't actually just mean those three words. It may mean actually that as the lead-in to the Ashamnu acrostic, but which is still mm-hmm. short, but which includes also these keywords Avinu, Pashanu, which add those other dimensions of what the high priest talks about of Avonot and Pishayim and Chatotam. But everyone kind of agrees that if all you did in that section of the Amidah basically was the Ashamnu paragraph with that introduction of Avala Nachnu Chatanu, that has ticked off the box of the Vidui. And I think what I'm struggling with and what I find powerful is there a way in which, right, nothing we're doing this year is lichatchila, is ideal and as we would plan it. But is there a kind of unexpected way in which the coronavirus might force us to confront a briefer but more intense and more authentic vidui than we would otherwise have the space to explore in other years?
Yeah, it's a very different approach. I feel like there is something really powerful about the repetition of over and over and over and over again. And there's a way in which I feel like we've all taken quite a beating this year, actually. And it may be that like we are in that place. Maybe we've done some of that chest beating work over the past few months, that maybe we're a little bit raw enough that we may be able to get to that more genuine, authentic Chatati place in a way that in other years, you know, we're so go that we actually need all of that time to say, like, sit in your chair and think about what you've done. We've done a lot of sitting in our chairs and thinking about ourselves. We've spent a lot of time with ourselves in the last 6 months. You know, maybe that's open to us in a different way. Rav Aviva, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, you know, as I'm hearing you talk through this, I wanted to reflect in actually two very different directions on this question about vidoy in the singular and how much do we say versus vidoy in the plural. I would say one thing I want to say is, yes, we are so used to tefillah being in the plural, and I do think this year in a lot of ways that sense of feeling alone and saying those words in the plural, even though it might seem out of sync, actually expresses so much how we want to feel connected in a much larger way to community. But I will say that I think one of the things that this time it has opened up is thinking about different rituals that are really centered around the home, different prayers that are centered around the home, as many of us are sort of facing a holiday experience of being more at home. And I'm excited to share this on Erev Yom Kippur, and we're having a whole day of learning then. But there are tchinas, there are women's prayers that were written in Yiddish, kind of from the early modern period, that are often in the singular and sometimes invite a more personal type tefillah. And I'm thinking of one that's actually connected to what seems to be sort of early roots of making the Yizkor candle on Erev Yom Kippur, and saying a prayer and really extreme personalization, right? Reciting the names of particular relatives who had passed away that year as you sort of dip the wicks into the wax. And I'm mentioning that because I do think it is a time when we're asking, well, what tefillot should I say this year? There is the dimension of let's cut what we need to so it's more manageable and certainly to limit what we're doing in a communal space. But there's also sort of a wealth of tefillot and traditions to draw upon that are really centered for being at home and for that more personal voice to come out. And I encourage people to explore that.
Yeah, I think the Yizkor candle on its own, I imagine even people who don't have a loss, Yizkor is always profound for anyone who's had a loss ever, particularly for anyone who's had a loss in a year. But I would say we as a society, as a culture, are so desperately in need for a communal mourning moment to say, yes, there is fear and there's anxiety and there are all these other things. And there was tremendous loss this year. And the fact that Yizkor can provide us, and in particular, the Yizkor candle, which, as you say, is a home ritual, can provide us actually with an outlet to actually stop and acknowledge some of that loss and invite that presence into our tefillot this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very powerful kind of way to go in thinking about this, but I also really want to stress the other direction of feeling connected to the public and collective language around sin this year in particular, as we are in the midst of a more broad reckoning with racial injustice, to think of what it means individually to be saying, or some elements of al-khayt seem to be such egregious sins that we're like, I haven't killed anybody this year. Why am I saying this? Al-khayt, and it can sort of make the whole thing seem not genuine. And I do think that this year, as we're thinking about what collective responsibility means, right? What does it look like to stare at consequences, things that are really off in our world, and have more of a sense of collective responsibility around that, is an extremely powerful mode to be in. So on a technical perspective, yes, you do still say Pinoy in the collective language. And I guess what I'm saying is I think that that can resonate in extremely powerful ways as we're thinking about the continuation of structural racism, as we think about the collective deeds that lead to climate crisis, to actually sort of own the real disasters that are happening, even if we can't always draw a specific line from the specific thing that we did that has led to X consequence, realizing that there is a need for a more collective sense of responsibility.
Yeah. Is very important. I so appreciate that. And I think it also speaks even to the pandemic itself, in terms of this pandemic being something that we cannot solve on our own, right? No person on this call can individually change your actions in a way that is going to change the situation in the world. It is, you know, this idea of interconnectedness and responsibility for each other is present in ways that are just more extreme and clear than they have ever been. That I so appreciate also that feeling of, it may be that the Bidui feels tone deaf because I'm by myself, and it may be that the Bidui has actually never felt so obvious to us, and so useful in terms of providing us with language to take some of that responsibility that is maybe hard to generate in just the Khatati mode. If I stay in just the Khatati, I may not be able to get to those places and think, God, we have this liturgy that can help us get there this year and help keep us connected. All right, we are going to pause for a minute. I want to invite everyone to put your questions in the chat. This is your moment. We've seen some trickle in. Anyone who's on this call, you know, we have an opportunity to hear all of our questions and hopefully answer some of them. But even if we don't get to answer them, I think it's so important to hear the questions that other people are thinking and struggling with in this time. So take your time now to type in some questions. And I will introduce our lightning round, which is totally counter to the way we operate on this podcast, right? We take simple questions and we give long, complicated answers. But what we are going to do now is a lightning round. And the rule of the lightning round is we're going to get some quick answers. I have told Rav Aviva and Rav Eitan, they have two sentences only to answer questions, and they're going to trust us that we know that they have many further thoughts on all of these questions. But we're going to get some quick answers.
I don't know if I can handle this. I just want to say for the record.
You know, three sentences max, let's say. And we'll get some answers, and then we'll see if we have time for a couple more questions from the chat. Okay, are you ready?
Let's go.
Question number one. Do we need to hear the shofar this year? Okay, sorry, it's a three-part question. How many blasts are needed, and can I fulfill the hearing of the shofar on Zoom? What do you have to say?
Rav Aviva, you want to go ahead?
Okay, I'll start this. The minimum number of shofar blasts that one needs to hear is 30. There's a minhag to do 100. The 30 blasts that are part of the shofar service, that is the minimum. Also, one would ideally be doing 4 at least. The minimum of 4 for Malchiot, Zichronot, and Shofrot in the repetition of the Musaf Amida. It is necessary to hear the shofar clearly, the sound of the shofar. The person blowing it needs to have in mind that the people listening to it are fulfilling the obligation. People listening to it need to have in mind that they are fulfilling the obligation. So if you just happen to overhear someone who you think down the hall in your apartment building is blowing a shofar, maybe right? That wouldn't necessarily count. But if someone comes outside your window to blow the shofar, that could count.
All right. And can it count on Zoom?
So Zoom is complicated. The main issue in the
Michelle. No complicated answers.
No complicated. Kol havara, right? There's the problem of having a distorted or echo sound. There's a lot of discussion around how the microphone, telephone, and digital recording of the sound affects that. There is maybe an argument to be made once it's become an extremely normal way of hearing people. Certainly, there's somewhat of an argument to be made that could count. Probably on a landline where there's the clearest sound and no delay would be the main track to go there. But ideally, one hears it live. And if you can't make that happen because it's not safe, then you're patur, you're exempt from shofar.
I would just emphasize that, which goes to one of the things that was asked here, I see in the chat, you know, just combining two things. You do have to hear the shofar on Rosh Hashanah itself in order to fulfill the obligation. So doing it even at night and doing it at a, you know, on another day beforehand doesn't count. It's got to be on the day itself. If you don't have a shofar and you're not able to hear it, there's no way to get to it, you're exempt. And if you, you know, if you take a hard line that you're really not hearing the original noise through an electronic medium, which is definitely where I tend, Rav Aviva. I'm not disputing anything Rav Aviva said in terms of some of the discussions that have happened. You know, I don't know. I would say to someone, if the only way you can hear it is that way, then you're exempt. You're not able to get there.
All right. Next question. Forget the shofar. How do I do a Torah service without a Torah?
That one's pretty easy.
The simplicity of this year's questions are.
Yeah, that's really easy. Telling. If you don't have a Sefer Torah, you should still read the Parsha. If you're able to do that in the Hebrew with the notes, the trup, that's what you should do. You can pause in the way you pause for Aliyot. If you're not able to do that, you should still read the text without the notes. If you're not able to read in the Hebrew, you should still read it in some translation. You don't do any formal brachot or blessings before and after. Same thing for the Haftarah, even though the Haftarah is not done over a special scroll in the same way, like you could read at home from the same kind of book you would read in the synagogue. Once it's not as a ritual attached to reading from a Torah scroll, you don't do the formal blessings on it before and after. So it's an opportunity to read those passages from the Bible, from the Torah, ideally musically, but no liturgical frame around it.
Okay, great. This question is probably most useful to people who are trying to organize some kind of minyanim. The question is, can we play with the timing of any of the services?
Right. So as people are trying to sort of pack in the most small services possible, right? Some questions are coming up around, can you delay shacharit? Ideally, shacharit is said up until the fourth hour. That's the fourth halachic hour, dividing the day into the 12 equal parts. And, you know, what if you need to have a late service? Can they do shacharit after that, but before noon? It's really ideal to have shacharit by the fourth hour. It's really not ideal to extend it until noon under pressing circumstances that could happen, but it's really not the main direction to go to. Better to have an early service. Musaf should be said before the seventh hour, but there is actually very strong reason to do Musaf later. Musaf by the seventh hour is the Chatchila, right? Ideally, but certainly one is Yotze in all ways. One is fully fulfilled it by doing it after the seventh hour as well. Possibly Mincha should happen first if Musaf is going to be delayed till after the seventh hour, though there's also room to not do that, to do Musaf first.
Yeah, and one way you can do that is if a synagogue is having sort of, you know, various musaf options for later in the day, you can suggest to people that if there's a musaf that's happening, you know, quite later in the afternoon and they're not going to be at a mincha in any public way, they can do the mincha amida privately beforehand and, you know, fulfill their obligation that way.
Great. And someone wrote in a question that I've heard a lot also, which is, can we do the Kol Nidre prayer before our Chag starts on Zoom, if we're someone who's not using Zoom on Chag and not leaving the house at all?
Yeah, so, you know, in many communities, they're very careful to make sure that Kol Nidre is done before sunset. And that's to reflect the at least the aspect of Kol Nidre that is a formal court releasing vows, which is something that should not happen on a sacred day, but only before it. There's a whole other dimension of Kol Nidre, mainly the text that Moshe Ashkenazim say, where it's just a sort of conditioned statement about the next year's vows. Truth be told, either way, doing it before sunset is completely fine. You know, doing it, as the question here is, before the Suda Mafseket, before the final meal. So, you know, that's aesthetically a little bit different. But formally, what's going on there, you know, is something that definitely can be done before. And I do think in a year where there may be communities that are saying, we're not feeling like it's appropriate or in our understanding of what we can do on Yom Kippur to be Zooming or live streaming, but we really want opportunity to connect in a broader way, I think it's a very good idea to find a way to do Kol Nidre over Zoom. And there's no reason that Kol Nidre cannot be in its full form. And, you know, even three people might be highlighted on the screen as sort of being the Beit Din in some way. The one thing I would say that you do have to be careful is the end of Kol Nidre, as it's laid out in the Machzor, concludes with the Shehecheyanu blessing. And the Shehecheyanu blessing reflects the sanctity of the day of Yom Kippur. And actually, by saying it, you accept upon yourself Kiddushat Hayom, that you're, it's like when you light candles, you know, on Shabbat for many people. So anyone, you know, wanting Kol Nidre to be happening before Yom Kippur has to just make sure to stop before Shehecheyanu and do that later on.
Yeah, great. And I'll jump back a question to also point out that those who are worried about being lonely with their vidui is also that there is a vidui in the mincha service on the day before. That's also maybe an opportunity to do a communal Zoom vidui if that's something your community is interested in, that gives you a chance to do that, not on the chag.
Right. So exactly. The public Amida in the mincha before Yom Kippur doesn't have it as part of the repetition, but you could have people praying privately and then sort of essentially doing that vidui aloud together, you know, over Zoom in some way. It's another great way. And I'll add, just because someone put it here, another thing that certainly can be done that way is Yizkor. There have been a lot of communities that have been doing that. Yizkor is something that traditionally ended up on Yom Kippur and other festival days. But to do that service of remembrance during Aseret Yemei Tshuva, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, whenever is convenient for people to gather, is certainly possible and also seems like a good and powerful idea.
I'll say, you know, in the really extreme, I've even heard of people doing sermons before the day, before the timing. And maybe I'll make an invitation to everybody here that actually Hadar will be offering a series of drashot, a series of high holiday sermons throughout the season that will all be like the Erev of the Erev, the night before the Erev of the Chag, that people are invited to join into. And also, as Rav Aviva mentioned, we're going to have sort of a day long of learning and ritual pre-Yom Kippur leading up to, and hopefully with Mincha as a part of that day also. Okay, last question of your lightning round. People will stay with us a few more minutes to hear. Can we say Slichot with the 13 attributes of God without a minion?
I can start. You'll fill in. I'll just give the basic idea. The basic idea here is that Slichot, or the 13 attributes of God, is described in the Talmud as something that God performed as a shliach tzibur. God performed as a communal prayer leader in front of Moshe. And when we do it, we are sort of mimicking that. And that develops the whole idea that kind of the context for saying the 13 attributes should be one that fits with our notion of communal prayer. Ergo, you need a minyan, and all sorts of other things. So if you don't have a minyan, the standard understanding, that there was some argument about this, is you don't say the 13 attributes. Now, in the wake of that, right, some people, clearly dying to say this in some way, said, well, what do you mean? They're just verses. I'm allowed to say verses from the Torah. And so what you find is in the Shulchan Aruch, the ruling is, you're allowed to say those verses as long as you chant them with the trup, with the cantillation. In other words, you can't scream them out like a prayer. You have to be like, I'm citing a verse from the Bible. And it actually, I think, is a powerful way of marking, we're doing this, but not in the normal way. And actually, when you sing something with the trup, it does not have the same plaintive quality. It has maybe an aesthetic quality. And so that allows you then basically to say those prayers, because the El Melech Yoshev and the other introductory things are just poems that you're certainly allowed to say. And then there's some sort of discussion. Do you need to finish the verse? You know, V'chata'a v'nakeh, go on with nakeh, lo yenakeh, because if you're citing the verse, you should say the whole verse. But Rav Ovadia Yosef, among others, says, no, as long as you're chanting it with the tune, we know you're saying it in an appropriate way. I think communities might make different decisions about that, or groups of people, right, might make different decisions. Going back to Rav Aviva's sort of different needs for different people, I think some people are feeling like, I don't want to, you know, fake a communal davening where I don't have it. And so I really want it to be like very clear that I'm not doing that. Others of us are feeling so intensely the isolation, we're finding any way within the bounds of what feels like it's normatively continuous with the past to get us as close to that experience as possible.
Yeah, I'll say different people will have probably different tefillot, and not even different tefillot, different aspects of the experience that missing that piece is going to hurt the most. And I think for me personally, it is actually the slichot and the repetition of these 13 attributes of God. That's the part of tefillot for me, you know, where my soul really comes alive, that I know I will really viscerally miss this year. I think for different people, that's different elements. But I know this question, I feel in a personal way that it feels so much deeper than just a matter of like, yes, no, I got my highlighter. Should I say it? Should I not? It's like, but do I get to cry out to God or do I not? And so I feel like there's a lot at stake in these questions. All right. Is there... Rav Viva, Rav Eitan, do you want to have one final word before I close this out?
I'll just say one sentence, which is, yes, there is a lot of a sense of loss around what will be different. But I also think it is a moment that's calling on all of us, for example, to tune in for an hour and talk about Hilchot Yamim Noraim and Tfila. And there's so much that I think we are sowing in ourselves and our greater familiarity with the experience of tefillah and what it is about, that hopefully we can reap in the future.
Yes, I feel like everybody this year has had to up our game in terms of our intentionality about how we intend to celebrate the holidays this year. You know, even people who are used to just showing up and sitting in their seat, you know, suddenly they have an email from their shul saying like, how do you intend to celebrate the holiday this year? And you have to actually give that some thought. And some of us are really learning which parts of the tefillot are core. You know, I feel like even at the level of Rav Eitan and Rav Aviva, who are sitting to do research that they never had to do before on exactly which verses do we need, all the way to people who really never thought about the high holidays, and they now have to decide, what, if anything, am I doing to acknowledge it on my own? So in a way, this moment has provided that opportunity for all of us to go a bit deeper and to learn a bit more. We as Hadar hope to be as supportive of that as possible. So I'll say, just reference a few guides and resources that are coming your way. One is that we put together a reader with essays and wisdom for this year that you could sign up to have mailed to you, but also you can already download online, which is on the theme of being alone and together. And touches on a lot of the themes that we've discussed this year. We also are publishing a spiritual guide for the day, which just gives you some advice and questions for how to break up your day. If you're not breaking up your day by going to shul, coming home from shul, having lunch with friends. And finally is what Rav Aviva was mentioning, a halachic guide that really gets into the nitty gritty of how to get through the day on the halachic level, including some actual abbreviated tefillot for you to use as a guide. Responsa Radio is a project of the Hadar Institute and Jewish Public Media. Thanks to Elise Rose for producing this Zoom podcast and to Noah Gemler for editing this episode. Have a halachic question you'd like answered on the show? Email us at halacha@hadar.org. That's halacha@hadar.org.